of making sure that the checks and balances when it comes to political statements and propaganda are in place.
Mohammed, I want to ask you a last question. If you could talk about your decision when you left Gaza, you stayed in Cairo to try to readjust, almost afraid to come home to Manchester. Can you talk about that transition, what you face now, what you're calling for?
I mean, so my heart is still in Gaza. I did not want to leave Gaza because I knew when I was in Gaza, I knew that I was there, I was present in the moment, and the only struggle that I was facing was that of surviving and telling our story. And now, I guess, outside Gaza, it's obviously I'm glad to be physically safe. But at the same time, I have like a very, very heavy weight of responsibility to keep honoring and amplifying the voices of like my country, people in Gaza, and making sure that we keep up the political pressure to make sure that, you know, that first of all, there's a ceasefire and that Israel and its allies are held accountable. And so I'm so glad that South Africa has brought this case at the International Court for Justice. And, you know, I think this would not have been possible without the voices of millions of supporters of Palestine protesting in very, very difficult conditions, like a political climate that is so hostile, that accuses you of anti-Semitism, even though it's the last thing that people are doing by criticizing Israel. And I think it's so important to keep up that pressure. And I'm adding my voice to that. And if I may, maybe just for a moment, speak of Amplify Gaza Stories, an initiative that I set up with friends and campaigners in Manchester, where, you know, we like ultimately wanted to, we know, obviously, you know, that there's a narrative that's predominant in terms of putting the Israeli narrative in front of the Palestinian narrative. And we felt, you know, there was always space for getting more Palestinian voices out there. And, you know, so we did this by, I took testimony, I interviewed people in Gaza, and we translated it and got it either published on social media pushed it to other platforms. And it's something that we're continuing along with a network of contacts in Gaza to make sure that the Palestinian voices are heard. And it's a two-way thing as well, because we're also working on practical solidarity. So, for example, we have at the moment, we're raising money on a crowdfunder to support families cooking hot meals for their immediate community. So it's kind of about ensuring that they have the means for resilience, because I think right now one part of Israel's strategy is battering down the resilience of Palestinians, so that people are so battered and broken that they can't like resist through their existence, and that's what we're trying to do to help them.
There's so much more to talk about, Mohammed, but we have to end here. Mohammed Galayini is a British Palestinian air quality scientist, spent nearly 3 months in Gaza, has just recently returned to Manchester, England. He returned on Wednesday, co-founder of Amplify Gaza Stories. Coming up, hundreds of Jewish activists and their allies shut down the California state capitol in Sacramento Wednesday to demand a ceasefire in Gaza. We'll speak with one of them, a former IDF soldier, a descendant of Holocaust survivors, back in 20 seconds.
دم الشهيد فيها قصة مكتوبة نصر طلعتنا إلا من بحر النهر يا ما قلنا بكرة أحلى بس لا ما شفنا إلا قهر طلبنا بس
Regine, We Will Return by 25 artists from the Middle East and North Africa. The proceeds from the song will be donated to the Palestine Children's Relief Fund. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We continue our coverage of Gaza as we turn to California, where hundreds of Jewish activists and their allies shut down the California State Capitol in Sacramento Wednesday during its first floor session of the new year to demand a ceasefire in Gaza. As chants rang out, the activists dropped banners that read, "No U.S. funding for Israel's genocide in Palestine." Another banner noted, "California taxpayers contribute some $600 million to U.S. military aid to Israel each year." The direct action was organized by Jewish Voices for Peace, If Not Now, and the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, among others. One of the protesters was a former Israeli IDF soldier, an Israeli Defense Force soldier, who will join us in a minute from San Francisco. This is Meital Yaniv addressing their fellow demonstrators.
My elders, state, family had meticulously taught me how to recognize genocide from infancy, how naked bodies get rounded up for torture and execution, how mass graves smell, how starvation and hate shapes a body, how ethnic cleansing entire lineages and buries the wisdom of the land caretakers. The black and white images are now in color. The stories are live. And in this cycle, we don't need gas chambers because we have U.S.-made bombs.
That's Meital Yaniv addressing Wednesday's protests that shut down the California State Assembly. An organizer with Shoresh, a new Israeli anti-Zionist group based in the U.S., they were born in Tel Aviv. They're a former IDF soldier, which they write about in their new book, Bloodlines. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Meital. Can you talk about why you've decided to take the stand and talk about what you did as an Israeli soldier and your change of heart?
Yes, thank you, Amy, for having me, and thank you for the work that you do. So I was raised in a very, I would say, extremely Zionist family, but also very common way of being raised in Israel. I have a lot of war heroes in my family, fallen soldiers, Lehi recruiters, Air Force commanders, and the like, Mossad agents. And as the child of my father, I was recruited into the Air Force. And after 6 months of serving, my base was moved from Tel Aviv to the south. This was 2002. And I was asked to send planes to fuel planes that were going into Gaza, to bomb Gaza. At that time, I didn't have the language to understand exactly what's happening. But as we returned to the base, I had my first panic attack and couldn't enter the base. And the next day had to come and stand trial. And I was grounded to the base for 3 weeks. And in those 3 weeks, I understand that I have to leave the army. And that, knowing at that moment, made me want to take my life because it was so against everything I was taught. And that started a process that I will be in for the rest of my life, which is the undoing of that indoctrination and that brainwashing. And the way that the Israeli identity has been merged with the Zionist identity. And what I'm doing with Bloodlines and the prayer that is Bloodlines is to really bring the Israeli identity and Israeli state to a loving and caring death for the liberation of the land of Palestine.
What year was that? What year did you bomb Gaza?
2002.
So 2002, we're talking about 20 years. And you're in a very elite group, the Israeli Air Force. Talk about that. There are actually a number of dissenters within that. For example, the well-known resistor, Yonatan Shapira, and others. And what it means for you now to speak out and how much support you have publicly in Israel and maybe privately, people who are afraid to speak out.
Yeah, my need to leave the army at the time really came from my body said no. And it was an elite situation. Like, we all want to be in the Air Force for different reasons. We're also 18-year-olds that at the time, you know, we feel like that the Air Force has better conditions, and it is considered a perk. And leaving the Army was, at that time, felt an impossible decision, and also there was no other decision in my body, so I had to follow that. And in terms of being heard, I am trying to be heard as loudly as I can, because I do think that the only thing that is really unique about my experience is that I was raised extremely Zionistic and have walked here to the very other shore. And I remember each step. And from that place, I can compassionately relate to where everyone is at. But to reach voices inside Israel is extremely hard. I'm grateful to be a member of Shoresh, and that is kind of like the work that we're trying to do here, is really find ways to be heard here and there. Yeah.
I should be more specific. As a former IDF soldier, you were responsible for assigning planes that the Israeli Air Force sent to refuel the other planes that were bombing Gaza?
Yes.
That was
so
your job.
My job was to send basically fuel planes.
But you didn't actually fly F-16, those planes.
I'm assuming. No, I was on the ground.
Mm-hmm. So if you can talk about the equation that some critics, pro-Israel advocates, make of being anti-Zionist with being anti-Semitic.
Yeah, I think the issue here, you know, I was raised extremely Israeli, which was also meant that I wasn't raised very Jewish, which is also a very common thing. The way that the assimilation into Israeli identity happened within my lineages was to really, like, remove the Jewishness and really become this, like, tzabar, heroic IDF soldier identity. And from that place, it's almost impossible from that place to... sorry, Amy, can you repeat your question?
I was just saying if you can comment on those who say to be anti-Zionist is to be anti-Semitic.
Yes. Thank you. From that merging, you know, the Zionist identity, a part of that propaganda is to really hold it within the cage of anti-Semitism. Like, every time that we criticize Israel, someone can say, you're anti-Semitic. But in reality, there's nothing anti-Semitic about criticizing Israel. The merging of Israel with Judaism is something that Israel would like us to hold as a way to protect itself. But in reality, anti-Semitism is a very specific thing that we are not causing it, and we will not undo it. And the only thing we can do is to continue to resist it. And at the same time, what Israel is doing right now has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. What Israel is doing right now is a genocide. What Israel has been doing for the past 75 years is apartheid, is occupation. The techniques that are being used in the West Bank are clearly apartheid techniques that have nothing to do with anti-Semitism. So criticizing that, walking in streets that are only for Israelis, that Palestinians are not able to walk on in Hebron, there's nothing anti-Semitic about criticizing that. Like, that is something that we are doing as Israelis.
And can you talk about how you are informed by your, by the fact that you're a descendant of Holocaust survivors?
Yeah, and that is really something that I think has really formed my identity. And that is something also that I think really helps with the undoing of it all. Because I really feel that that trauma seed really started there. And that is something that I'm also trying to do in Bloodline, where I start with the story of my great-grandma telling their story of survival. Because in that story of survival, there's also the need to escape. And in that need, the need to assimilate into a new identity of a colonizer, of a settler colony. And in the doing of that, there was a there wasn't a moment of care to take care of what just happened in their bodies. And that became a need to arm ourselves. I mean, I feel like I see it as a fear of annihilation, also an extreme form of victimhood that is in our bodies. And from that place, it's always been very, very hard when I see my elders to release the arms and to really tend to that original trauma and seed of the Holocaust.
Meital, as we wrap up, I wanted to ask you what message you have for young people like Tal Mitnick, who is a refusenik, who's refusing to be an Israeli soldier in the occupied territories, to these young people, and here you are in the United States shutting down the California legislature to the United States, your message.
Mm-hmm. My message is, first of all, for everyone who can, to just find their heart and to liberate themselves from this identity that we call an Israeli identity. And there is no need for any one of us to serve in the IDF. The IDF should not exist. The state of Israel should not exist. We can be free without it. We can have a true connection to our heart without that identity. To the U.S. legislators in California, you know, the fact that we were even able to take a break while there's a genocide happening is an impossible idea to hold. And in this moment, when you're back from the break, we shut it down on one day, but now you really need to make decisions. And, you know, in the federal level, we are not being heard. So please, I beg of you, make this stop in whatever way you can.
Meital Yaniv, organizer with Shoresh, a new U.S.-based Israeli anti-Zionist group, born in Tel Aviv, former IDF soldier, descendant of Holocaust survivors. Their new book is titled Bloodlines. Next up, Ralph Nader on Gaza, on what's happening today in the world, and his new book, The Rebellious CEO. Stay with us. By McCarthy. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show with Ralph Nader, longtime consumer advocate, corporate critic, four-time former presidential candidate. We'll talk to him about several topics, including his new book, The Rebellious CEO, 12 Leaders Who Did It Right. He's also the founder of Capitol Hill Citizen Newspaper, has been named by Time and Life magazines one of the 100 most influential Americans of the 20th century. But, Ralph, let's begin with U.S. policy in Gaza. Amidst the protests nationwide calling for a ceasefire, senior Biden education official Tariq Habash resigned this week. He's the first Biden appointee over what he called Biden's, quote, complete unwillingness to demand an immediate and permanent ceasefire in Gaza. Biden's facing re-election amidst a broader Middle East conflict. Ralph, you said, quote, Biden and Congress are vigorously enabling the annihilations in Gaza. What do you mean, and what do you feel needs to happen?
Well, the important thing in the U.S. here is to focus on Congress and the White House, because they are waist-deep in this genocidal war in Gaza. The Congress is basically a rubber stamp and doesn't even have public hearings as it shovels billions of dollars to Israel. And it's about to pass, unless Bernie Sanders and others who are opposed, a $14.3 billion, with a B, dollar appropriation for Israel, military arms, and other aspects of the Israeli right-wing regime's priorities. And that $14.3 billion is larger than the budget of the Environmental Protection Agency. It's 20 times the budget of the Occupational Safety and Health Agency. It's four times the budget of the National Park Service, which has 300 million visitors. So there is rising opposition to it in the Congress, mostly among Democrats. but not enough. And I think the Jewish Voice for Peace and other valiant people who are resisting should focus more on the Congress. As far as Biden's concerned, it really gives a new meaning to hypocrisy. He keeps saying publicly that Israel should reduce its impact on civilian casualties and let humanitarian trucks in. At the same time, he's sending ships full of munitions and cargo planes full of munitions to Netanyahu. You cannot have humanitarian trucks coming in, and it needs to be about 700 at least a day if you don't have a ceasefire. Because who's going to go in? The roads are torn up. They can't get to their destination. The hospitals and clinics have been destroyed or disabled. There's no markets. There's no ability to receive these materials. And the Israelis are letting in maybe 10, 20 trucks a day, but they're delaying hundreds and hundreds of trucks ready to come in, which Biden has already paid for. So Biden is playing Netanyahu's game, but he's trying to get away with highfalutin adherence to international law. We don't hear enough about the violation of international law, U.S. treaties, Geneva Convention. It's as if the U.S. can do anything it wants in Syria and Iraq, and Israel can continue to bomb repeatedly in Syria and do other violent acts. And the press never raises the issue of law. Without law, you have anarchy. You have all what you're seeing now. And the U.S. is very much involved, and people are very concerned about a wider conflict here. The Israelis already struck in Beirut, and you have the Red Sea situation with the Houthi boats. And the U.S. is all over the place, aircraft carriers. They have 24/7 drones over Gaza. So that'll be a very good record when the reckoning comes after this war is over.
In fact, you are Lebanese-American, Ralph. Is that right? Your family from Lebanon.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you a question that relates to this. You know, the protests around Gaza on college campuses around the country ultimately have led to the ouster of two college presidents, Liz McGill at UPenn, and now you have Claudine Gay. And I wanted to ask you about the protest yesterday led by Al Sharpton outside the New York office of the billionaire investor Bill Ackman, who helped lead a campaign that led to this week's ouster of the Harvard University president, the first black president of Harvard, Claudine Gay. Ackman, Harvard alum, major donor of the university, has publicly railed against Harvard and other schools for supporting DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Al Sharpton vowed to keep protesting outside Ackman's office. This is what he said.
We have started these weekly one-hour protests in front of Mr. Ackerman's office. He has said that the resignation of Ms. Dr. Gay at Harvard is not the end of it. They're going to keep fighting till they end DEI, which is diversity, equity, and inclusion. That's declaring a war on all of us, blacks, women, gays. DEI was designed to bring fairness and equality to people that had been historically marginalized and eliminated.
So that's Al Sharpton. As part of his campaign to oust Gay as Harvard president, Bill Ackman helped amplify allegations that Gay committed plagiarism in her academic work. But now Ackman's wife, the MIT professor Neri Oxman, is facing a plagiarism scandal of her own. Business Insiders revealed Oxman plagiarized parts of her doctoral dissertation at MIT. On Thursday, she apologized and admitted making mistakes. Of course, there was no plagiarism panel that was set up. That's the process at Harvard that would evaluate President Gay before she was ultimately, I guess you could probably say, pushed out by Harvard Corporation with a lot of pressure from these major donors like Bill Ackman. Your response before we move into your book on corporate executives who did it right.
What's been revealed is the big donors to these universities, especially private universities like Harvard, Yale, Princeton, have been exercising their baleful influence for many years over the curriculum. You know, it's not surprising that Harvard Law School for decades never had a course on corporate law, corporate crime, rather. So these large donors now have been revealed to have enormous power over the board of overseers over Harvard University. And that's the next investigation for good news, student newspapers like the Harvard Crimson. The stuff on plagiarism, it could be serious, but not in this case, given the review of the president's past writings. The big issue is the slaughter, is the suppression of speech on college campuses, dealing with the slaughter over there in Gaza. And the fatality count is grossly undercounted, Amy. I know you refer to the official Hamas Health Authority count, where they only count people whose names they know who died. And so it's over 22,000, 58,000 injury. This is a massive undercount. As the head of the Global Health Department, University of Edinburgh, said in an article in The Guardian the other day, there's going to be 500,000 Gazans are going to die before the end of this year, not only from the bombing, but from the effect of the bombing in terms of the destruction of the healthcare system, infectious diseases, polluted water, diarrhea, which little children, which is often a high rate of fatality and very quickly, lack of any food, no shelter, 85% of the 2.3 million people homeless. They have no connection to sanitation, food, protection, the winter elements. Estimate now is at least 100,000 have died, and more will die every day because of the effects that I've just described. The World Health Organization said they've never seen a situation like this in decades. The amount of number of children being killed in November, it was 150 a day from the Israeli bombing, and that's compared to two a day in Afghanistan and less than one a day in Ukraine. So that's the main issue. And at the campus controversy, talking about slurs and ethnic slurs and so forth, what's behind it all is to repress the academic world from speaking out and acting on what our government is doing to make all this possible. And then we also have to focus on these corporations. For a lot of this aid to Israel bounces back into contracts for missiles, Raytheon, Boeing, Lockheed Martin. They're raking it in. And people talk about the lobby in this country supporting any Israeli government can do no wrong, no matter how extreme. We have to talk about the military-industrial complex here on Capitol Hill, pushing for more and more of these immense sales and profits.
Ralph, you just wrote a book. You are deeply critical right now of the corporations you just mentioned. But your book is The Rebellious CEO, 12 Leaders Who Did It Right. Some may be surprised to see you, this corporate critic, writing this book, famous for Unsafe at Any Speed, The Designed Endangers of the American Automobile, among other things. But in this last minute, and then we'll do a post-show interview, talk about why you wrote it.
Because there's not enough good yardsticks to evaluate the misbehavior of giant CEOs of these multinational corporations who distort markets, control markets, but they tell you when you criticize them for their munitions production, for opiates, for fossil fuels, for high drug prices, well, we're just meeting market demand. Well, these 12 CEOs, they made profit, but they reversed the business model, focusing on protecting, treating workers right, consumers right, and environment. And they spoke out against war. They spoke out against Anita Roddick of Body Shop, spoke out against the cosmetic industry's harm on young customers. Ray Anderson changed his entire...
We have to leave it there, but we're going to do part two, posted at democracynow.org. Ralph Nader, author of The Rebellious CEO, 12 Leaders Who Did It Right. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
He could be 30. He could be 50. Life has aged him beyond his years. A shopping cart carries everything he owns. Here he comes, toward you. What you think you know about how he got here is probably wrong. Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.